Zanet, Cameron, Brazil, Bonanichana, Savakaya, Tatsu, and the Pamina, Asmai, Sri, Guruvay, Namaha, Pancha, Kalpa, Kuru, Dresta, Upa, Shindu, Baye, Vacha, Patipanam, Pavanebhyo, Vaishnavebhyo, Namo, Namah, Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasudeva Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
This is different than what I usually do, but I have the seminar today. It just conflicts with the weekly Sangha. So just leave the phone on if you find it interesting, fine. Okay? I'll be right back with you in a minute. Hey, I'm going to have to explain to you how I'm going to start. The last 3.5 years, I've been giving a phone conference on some type of Shastra or sacred text of India. It happens to be 9 o'clock on Sunday. So I told the group that if they want, they can listen in to this seminar. So I'll just tell them. Okay. Can you hear me? Rati, are you there?
Arvo, yes.
Okay, you can. Okay, thank you. So, excuse what this may look like. So, thank you all for inviting me, and I will begin by telling you that you won't have a 4-hour lecture straight. We will have breaks, and we'll have a lot of time for questions also, and maybe some other exercises. But Paula, she told me she lost her voice a bit. Otherwise, she would have introduced me. My name is Dhanadhar Swami, and I've been a very ardent student of the Bhagavad Gita for maybe almost 40 years. I remember in 1974 when I first got a copy of Bhagavad Gita when I was in university. I was studying in the State University of New York at Binghamton. And graduated there and then went to grad school for a few years before I felt a strong calling to be a monk, which is not the direct philosophy of Bhagavad Gita, because the direct philosophy of Bhagavad Gita is what makes one spiritual, is the consciousness in which one does things and not the activity itself. But different people have different proclivities. So I felt I had that calling to live in an ashram, and I pursued that. And then later, I became a teacher of Bhagavad Gita in India. And Bhagavad Gita has 18 chapters, and we used to have courses of 18 weeks. We have 5 classes a week, each chapter. That was many, many years ago. So I have a passion to communicate these teachings. And usually the way it's done, either have long courses or I just speak on one verse and elaborate on that text, etc. Today I'm taking up the challenge of giving you an overview of the text itself. And I really feel that the class may be dialectic. It has to be questions and answers and discussions. That's generally the way that sacred texts are discussed. Everyone's saying that it more important than speaking the truth is having the truth understood. And that depends on the person's frame of reference. But generally, the way these texts are taught, the one who knows the text, he explains the text, and then the student responds with questions. And then the teacher can see what further does the person need to understand what I'm speaking. Right, let's say someone is teaching mathematics, for example, and they have a wrong conception of what the students understand. And then they begin to speak algebra or calculus or something, and then the students respond and see, well, oh, they don't have some of the preliminaries they need, so let's go back. So it's very important that we establish a proper frame of reference. So I am going to welcome discussion on the subject, and I am going to also explain some preliminary concepts in this. And of course, with 4 hours, we shouldn't sit. We should have some breaks. I have some pads. Ivaka, do you have those pads? Bring in the other ones, too, because I didn't know how many, so many students here. Great. What I think I'm going to do too occasionally is have free writing. Do you know what free writing is? You put your pen to the page, and you just have to keep on going. Even if you say, I don't know what I'm talking about. No. Because every once in a while, I think it's good to review the subjects that are spoken. And you could recall perhaps some points that made sense to you, a question. And what happens, too, expression accelerates learning greatly. So I think in a four-hour class, it's very important to have your own expressions. And it'll be for your own personal edification. But I've done this in seminars in India that I've attended with people teaching. And it's very, very nice. And then we can review. We'll get those out if it's not now. Maybe you can bring... It will give us a chance to review what we ourselves have realized about the subject. Any questions so far? I think that's pretty clear. Okay. Okay, so here's my strategy to give you an overview of this very, very important text. There's three texts. What that's called? I'm just going to look it up because I was reading something. The prefaces of the introduction. I'll read from this introduction. I brought four of the texts that I studied from. This is the Bhagavad Gita itself by my teacher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada, which has the word for word, the translations, and commentaries on the whole text. So I studied from that, and there are other commentaries. This is a friend of mine who I learned Bhagavad Gita from, who wrote a commentary to explain how the whole thing is linked together very, very nicely. A godbrother of mine wrote another commentary on the text, a contemporary one. And actually, they're all friends of mine by coincidence. And this is a Sanskrit scholar in India that wrote a commentary on the first chapter, which we're going to discuss extensively today. The first chapter has a very, very nice title called The Yoga of Depression, how the dejection and difficulties in life can be yoga. Yoga means. That's one definition of yoga. It's a means to understand. So how that the difficulties in life can be a means to understand something deeper about ourselves and the world. So let me read. This is from Dr. Satyanarayan Das, and he's a Sanskrit scholar. In fact, many of these people I've studied with myself. This is Burijan Das. When I really first studied the Bhagavad Gita deeply, I used to sit in his class. Introduction. The Bhagavad Gita is one of the most popular scriptures in the world. Traditionally, it is regarded as one of the three main Vedic scriptures comprising Prasthana Traya, or three royal paths leading to the ultimate goal of life. The importance of Prasthana Traya in Vedic philosophy can be discerned from the fact that almost all prominent teachers have traditionally written a commentary on these works. Unless the philosophical conclusions of their schools can be established on these books, the scholarly community wouldn't reject them. So the Bhagavad Gita is one of the most prominent texts of Indian thought. The title itself is very nice. Anybody know what Gita means? Gita means song. And Bhagavat means the divine, the absolute, the song of the absolute. It's part of a greater text, a text called Mahabharat. Bharat was a king of India. India is also known as Bharat. Mahabharat means the great history of India. And it's an incredibly riveting text. I forgot the name of a very popular dramatist who even made a drama of the Bhagavad Gita, of the Mahabharata. In fact, in India, I remember this very well. Mahabharata has been a bestseller in India for the last 5,000 years. There's no book more popular. There's Bhagavad, there's Mahabharata, and it's the philosophy illustrated in story form. They want spiritual truths to be communicated, and they have different strategies on how they do it. One is you illustrate it through stories. It's also about a war, so it catches your attention. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita is spoken in the midst of a war. So this great war is about to start, and the armies are on both sides, and it's the culmination of this whole great book. This great war is about to start, and then one of the leading generals becomes hesitant to fight, and Krishna, who is his charioteer, becomes his guru and starts instructing him. So it's the concept is the war, and everyone's focused. Maybe not so much now. People are focused like that one. Generally, too. I remember when I was young, I come from Brooklyn. I used to go to Manhattan Beach. If you're sitting there on the beach and then someone says, fight, 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 the whole beach runs to one side to find out what happens. But it was like this. Everyone was riveted and focused to hear this dialogue. This Mahabharata, when I was in India, television started to become popular, they made a series of this, the Mahabharata. And it was so intriguing and so interesting that all of India would stop on the hour that this particular text was spoken, to such an extent that they had to change the time of Parliament. Because not enough people in Parliament were attending because it was a conflict with this. So it was a very, very important and wonderful. I recommend that you read it. It's just a riveting drama filled with deep insight. Okay. Now, my strategy for giving this class is this. First, I want to give a preliminary description of yoga psychology, how the mind transforms according to the tradition of India and the sacred texts of India. That's actually called yoga. Basically, initially, things weren't divided up. It was just the philosophy of India. Later, people categorized different subjects. Yoga was actually the subject that dealt with psychology. It was the science of how the mind transforms. So I want to discuss a little bit about that. And then, after discussing the preliminary paradigm of how the mind transforms, I want to discuss the four main ways in which one can do so, which are called yogas. Yoga has many, many meanings, but this just means a school of thought that controls the mind and brings one to a higher state of consciousness. There's actually four main ways. We're going to concentrate on the first, which is the world and how our experiences in the world transform our consciousness if we approach them in the proper way. And that's the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita called Vishad Yoga, or the Yoga of Dejection, the Yoga of Distress. Then there's three other paths: Karma Yoga, the Yoga of Action, and then there is Jnana Yoga, the Yoga of Knowledge or Analysis. And then, yes, Jnana, thank you. J-N-A-N-A, pronounced G-Y-A-N-A, Jnana, or commonly pronounced that way. And then there's Bhakti, the Yoga of Devotion. Now, all these yogas were known. There was no necessity to write another book summarizing them. So the Bhagavad Gita is actually a book that's meant to prioritize them. It has a particular objective. It has many, many objectives, because it's going to present all yogas. But it's going to present and highlight the Yoga of Devotion. In fact, at the end of the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, when all the different yogas are mentioned, Krishna tells Arjuna, Yoginam api sarvesham madgatena taratmanam shradhavam bhajate yomam sneyukta mato mataha. Of all yogis, he who worships me with faith and devotion is the highest of all. And that's not inconsistent with the Yoga Sutras. When Patanjali, you all know the Yoga Sutras is the main text that just deals specifically with yoga, when he describes how to focus the mind and he recommends Ishvara Pranidhan. Pranidhan means to surrender, Ishvara means the divine. And he shows how you do it by chanting mantras that designate the divine. We can also discuss that too. Okay, some preliminary information about yoga, or Vedic, we'll call it Vedic philosophy for now. Basic idea between philosophy is to end misery and to give some type of higher experience, if possible. Of course, maybe there are philosophies that existentialism or something perhaps doesn't have that view. I do on my phone conference here have some philosophers. If I make any mistake in that way, they'll correct me or ask questions. But end misery, and to give some type, some higher type of awareness. We see that here in the world. I think one common factor, and it also has some support in Shastra, Anandamaya Abhyasat, means that our nature is to seek happiness. Everyone is seeking happiness in some form and trying to end misery in one sort. And even when someone does something that's miserable, it's because they think it will make them happy. If I commit suicide, I'll end my misery. I'll be better. So it's a common understanding. And in the general understanding of Vedic, the philosophy there is that happiness is not external. First thing, it's not external. First, it has to do with the mind. You can give yourself pleasure and move the mind to a form of less happiness, a mode, they call it. It's not just pleasure acquisitions things. They may have a connection, but it's not an absolute connection, certainly. So it deals with the mind. If you want to be happy and satisfied, you have to do things that are good for the mind. And more than the mind, there's a soul or a pure awareness that's beyond the mind. And unless you realize that is the happy state, that is the natural state, and unless one comes in contact with that, they can't be happy. So there's an objective. There's an objective to get there. And that's actually the purpose of yoga. That your before I get to that your happiness has to be directed properly. Your efforts for happiness should be directed on realizing the nature of your true being. And if you don't, you can't ultimately be happy. Because that's eternal. And everything else is temporary. Your body is temporary. Your mind is temporary. And therefore, they say that type of happiness has duality. Because the more pleasure you get from it, the more you invest in it, the more you're suffering because you're going to lose it. So there's two things here. So if you want to become happy and satisfied, you have to realize it's called the Purusha or the Atma, for the soul. In other words, you naturally are happy, but you're thinking you're not. And I'll give an example. Let's say your goal is to look thin and fit, and your happiness is your body. Now you go to a mirror, and the mirror is distorted. So you see yourself as overweight. And then you become in tremendous anxiety. Well, the anxiety is not in reality. It's in how you're perceiving things falsely. That's actually what yoga is actually about. It's creating the mind as a pure instrument for observation. Now, I generally demonstrate things with my hands. This is an ancient PowerPoint presentation, okay? Because you all have different familiarity with this, so a lack of it. So this is the mind. And the mind is actually an instrument. It's not you. It's how you it's the instrument by which you perceive things. So the mind, you basically it'll have different, it's like clay. And we know that the mind is always moving. The 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita discusses this extensively. The mind is always moving. So there's one mode that's called ignorance. And it's super, if you're looking through the mind through that lens, it super distorts your vision of the world. Its symptom is a lack of clarity and inertia. And this would be called passion. This would be intense desires, ambitions. That also will distort your vision, like a mirror. And this would be called goodness. It's like a mirror. When a mirror is in its natural state and clean, it can reflect things purely. So when your mind is in a pure state, it's called sattva, the natural state of matter, then you will see yourself clearly. There won't be problems. It's just like if you were sleeping and you had a dream, and in the dream, it was a nightmare, and you thought you had some terrible disease, then you'd need anxiety. But what would be your anxiety? Your anxiety would be the illusion that you're in, that you're not actually seeing reality. So this is a basic concept in this type of thought, that we have a nature that's okay, but because of a faulty means of perceiving things, be it ignorance or a lack of knowledge, we suffer. And therefore, suffering is removed by knowledge or proper realization or proper understanding. Yoga and all forms of yoga are meant to bring you to that state. And it's a great science. It's a great science of the mind and the soul, etc. Now, I'm going to explain maybe one more basic concept here. And then after this particular introductory section, we could see if there's any discussions. But the soul by nature is love and service. So if it wants to be the center, it wants to be the controller, it wants to be the enjoyer, it wants to adopt an egotistical or self-centered view of the world, to satisfy that desire, it has to be put in illusion. This may be, I'm not connecting here, so I'm going to maybe say it another way. Okay, I'll do it in another way. I'm going to explain to you what's spiritual and what's material. This is material. This is the consciousness which is false, it's antithetical to yourself, and it won't give you happiness. It'll put you in disharmony. One concept of happiness is harmony. The congruence between what you are and what you do and what you think. That's happy. And if there's incongruence, suffering is the symptom. And that suffering indicates there's something wrong. So here's the concept. You think yourself you're the subject, you're the center, and you see everything else as an object for you. That's the that's antithetical to love or spirit or devotion. When you see everything for you, when your desire becomes prominent, and others' desires become in the periphery. Just think of a relationship. Why doesn't a relationship work? This is no love. And what is love? Well, I can tell you what not love is. Each person is only thinking of their desire, seeing the world in that way, and wanting it to be that way, and believes it should be that way. This is how, I give you an example. Two people, they're okay. One's living in one room, one's living in another room, and they meet, and they get married, now they're living in the same room. Whose room is it? Right? They may have different physical constitutions. One person's constitution may be, in Ayurveda they call vata, they're cold. They always want the windows shut. The other person's is peak, always hot. They want the windows open. So when they live together, are the windows open or the windows closed? If each is very egotistical and not spiritual, they will think, because I desire the window open, the window in reality should be open. And if the other thinks I'm hot because I feel that way, then the window or the window should be open, then more cold, the window should be closed. You look at the world, your desire becomes prominent. You see the world according to that desire. You try to control the world according to that desire. It's the opposite of love. Eric Fromm wrote this book, The Art of Loving. It was about that. Narcissistic means the world. You see the world according to your desire. Love means you see the world according to others' desire. So spiritual means, yoga means, moving out of the center, developing love, devotion, developing that type of spirit. And that's what we are. And when we want the other, then our consciousness is projected on the mind and the body. Okay, you had a question. Go ahead. I want to be clear. We have legitimate desires and needs. That's no doubt. No, but so you understand that.
Yeah.
Beyond that, is it fear-driven? It is fear-driven. It's just misdirected. I mean, basically, there are books written about the fear of death, the fear of plurality. That's the same fear, which is an illusion. Death is an illusion. Death is an illusion of non-existence. That's not true. We actually have a soul and a spirit that's beyond the body and that's eternal, at least according to this philosophy which we're teaching today. So yeah, there's fear-driven. We're seeking eternality, we're seeking love, we're seeking, but we have a misdirected way of doing it. Yeah. A fear of not being happy. We want to be happy, we want to be satisfied, but because we have a misdirected conception of it, that our conception of happiness is this. That if I get the money, if I get the sex life, if I get the position, if I get the power, I'd be happy. Then we become fearful if any of those things are threatened. If I don't get the praise, and You see, it's a misdirected conception of happiness. True happiness is when our hearts are overflowing with devotion to the divine, which includes everything else. That's congruent with our nature. You ever heard of this term, dharma? There's many, many meanings to this term, dharma. But one term is very, very nice, and I'll explain it. Dharma means what? Has anybody heard this term? Anybody know it? What? Duty. Yes. Obligation and duty. What is our obligation or duty? And how do we determine it? But our obligation or duty depends on what we are. There's a very nice, I heard one Sanskrit scholar, and they gave the derivative for this term, duty, and it is a Sanskrit derivative, which means essence. Dharma means essence, because essence means the quality which cannot be taken away. What is the essence of water? Anybody can say? Yes. If I give you something, it's not wet, it's water. What's the essence of sugar? If I give you something, it's not sweet, it's not sugar. What's your essence? You see, unless what you know, what you're made of, and what you're made for, it's hard to be happy because you can never align your activity. So your duty is ultimately related with your essence or being. Ultimately. And what dharma or duty is, are those activities which bring you closer to that realization. And what's very nice in India is there's a very, very elaborate science of that. Because we're all at different levels of bodily existence, different levels of spiritual evolution. We have different attachments. They're not... Everyone has all the same duties. One man's food is another man's poison. So there's a whole science of every circumstance, what to do that will elevate your consciousness. That's really what dharma is. And that's really what the Bhagavad Gita is about. It's a beautiful book, actually. It's an amazing book because I've studied it so deeply and it's beautiful. And what is karma? Karma is the consciousness and activities that bring you away from the selfless nature of the self. Dharma brings you closer, karma brings you away. That's the nature of your soul. In other words, you're faced with what to do. You have a circumstance. You have to make a decision, right? The right decision is the decision that will improve your development and awareness. The wrong decision is the one that will bring it away. So dharma are those decisions, and there's a science of it. It's very, very elaborate in many, many ways. That's why the Bhagavad Gita is spoken, because we're going to get to it soon, but what was the decision that this person had to make and had to agonize over? It's an amazing thing. He's in a war. I'll go a little bit ahead before I finish this set. He's in a war, and he finds his relatives and his teacher on the other side. Now, does he fight? Does he not fight? What is my duty? It's very confusing. And it's a reason why that particular thing is brought away. So, in our general life, so karma are those activities that further implicate us in this entanglement, identification with the body and the mind. And dharma are activities that bring us closer. The science of action. Okay, I'll give one more thing in this section, and then we finished our first hour. And I'm just going to talk about the two paths. There comes a time in life where one makes this his objective. Right? You can live in a spiritual way, but then you actually develop a practice to really become aware of your true nature and overcome the attachments that bring you away from it. And basically, there's two paths. One is jnana, which means the path of analysis and renunciation. And the other path is bhakti, which means devotion and supplication to the divine. There's a path of devotion, there's a path of knowledge. And then there's karma, the path of action, but we'll discuss that separately. Okay, so this is a basic template of spiritual philosophy in India. It's to realize your true nature of the soul and to extract your consciousness from identification with prakriti or matter, the body and the mind, which is not you. And therefore, you go through these transformations. The heaviest one is death, and it's not even happening to you. But you suffer it due to the ignorance. And basically, the fear of death is a driving factor for a lot of the crazy things we do. So the matter is transforming. The soul is a pure nature of happiness. And to live in the soul is to live eternally in happiness. And that's the objective. And wherever you're at, there's a practical means recommended in Bhagavad Gita and Indian philosophy to move forward. It's very, very practical. Because it even recognizes we have strong attachments that bind us to the body, which will not be favorable for us to renounce. Because if we renounce them, we'll think of them more. So it's a very practical philosophy, what you do, how you regulate things, how you engage things, elevate yourself to a greater state of happiness in the life. Okay. Any questions so far? Yes, go ahead. In Sanskrit? Yeah, Vishad. V-I-S-A-D-A. Vishad Yoga. I think I'm going to try this now. Who needs a pad and pencil to do some free writing? You can hand it out, Deepaka. We'll just do this for 5 minutes to just get a slight break. Anybody who needs a pad? Okay. If you have, we have extras. And I'll tell you what we're going to do. And then we'll go to the next section. Anybody listening in here have a question or a comment for me while we're doing this? There's how many people here? Is that 30 people here, maybe? A nice group. So appreciative. Anybody need? Okay. Okay, this is what I'd like you to do. I'm just going to give you 5 minutes. What you do is you put your pen to the page, right? And what I'm going to ask you to do is... let me see what question I'll ask. Discuss points that you heard that you felt were relevant or not relevant. Okay, and what you do is just start writing. And yeah, I'm not going to force you to. It's for yourself. The pen just has to. When we start, we'll do it. Just write something that you heard that was relevant and was maybe important to you that you heard. And if you can't think of something, I can't think of anything to write, or then just write, oh, I remember this. but don't stop the pen from moving, okay? How about we try for 5 minutes is a lot? Okay, we'll do 2 minutes, okay? I'll tell you when. Okay. Okay, now, just start writing. Don't let the pen stop. Just anything that you remember from the class, any realizations, any points. And if you don't remember something, just don't stop. Just write, I don't remember, I don't remember. Keep the pen moving no matter what. This is just for you. You have no worries. Private thing. Just keep the pen moving. We actually have 15 more seconds, but I'm going to extend it for another minute because people seem to be writing something. So it's just so good to start expressing. It accelerates your learning process, your remembrance. Things are moving so rapidly, we're going to extend it for 1 more minute. It's just, and then that's it for sure. Okay? Okay, 15 more seconds, okay? Okay, stop. We'll have more time to do this, because after every hour period, you'll get a chance to do this. Now what you can do is look through it and pick out perhaps the sentence that you like the most. Okay, the sentence that you like the most, that perhaps, I won't force you, but if you had to share it with someone, that something you said was... Those of you that are still here, I'm going to begin the second section in a couple of minutes. I don't know who is here or not. If you want to pick out one sentence or something. What's that? You're going to share it with us? Yeah, okay, please, yes. Yes, that's actually a fact. Yoga chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga means to quell the mind, and the stage where the mind has to be completely detached from that, which is called satyaya. Thank you. Anybody else like to share? I'd appreciate it. Okay. Yes. Maybe you say your name, because now I'll get to know people. Yes, okay.
I've been thinking of that as well when you draw the
spirit. Thank you. Very nice. Very good. Yes. Your name?
Mother.
Mother. Yes. It's the essence. If you want. Anybody else? Yes. Then what's the next one?
Then following.
Finding your Dharma, then following your Dharma. Yes. Very nice. Thank you. Anybody else? Yes.
I think that because of my age, I have found that a lot of it has been experienced in my experience, but I was struck by other philosophies, which is the only question for anything to say to be in there.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Very nice. I ask you, why about your age did it make it more relevant?
I have missed a lot of things, and I have had a lot of beliefs and surroundings of well-being that were not enough to be true.
Okay. Yeah.
Nothing is true.
Yeah. And I'm also getting a little old. The world works, let us know that this is not a permanent place. Because the faculties of enjoyment, of control, diminish. You can delay it a little bit by yoga, but not that much. I mean, the knees, the hearing, the liver, the hair, so many things are telling us, in one sense, that this is the investment here is a losing proposition. Although, I have to say, and I want to make this very, very clear, in this type of philosophy, one's desires need to be fulfilled in an appropriate way to be mentally stable for the higher endeavor. It's not going to be a philosophy, as you see, that recommends someone to just renounce and give up everything. It's getting the proper consciousness and being very, very practical about what the goal is. It's very good. Anybody else like to share? This is nice. Yes. Your name, please. Like.
Juan Sam.
And yes.
And we spoke at the
They did a study of, they have world happiness factors and things like that, And funny, they found out that some of the poorest countries in the world had the highest happiness index, because the simplicity facilitated a more healthy state of mind. So if it's really the shape of your mind, it's really the condition of your mind And therefore, sometimes, you know, people that say they take alcohol, which gladdens them, but it moves the mind towards ignorance, which is the state of depression. So, you know, or, you know, just unrestricted sensual stimulation. It may move the mind towards passion and anxiety. Well, in other words, so there's not that absolute correlation, but there's a science of when you satisfy your desires, how to satisfy your desires, when to renounce your desires. But everything moves the mind to that. You're still here. So that everything moves the mind to sattva, its nature of being, where it can perceive itself. That's yoga. What is yoga? Yoga is meditative absorption. It's a very, very, it begins at a very, very high level of purity. The first angas of Ashtanga yoga, there's different yam, yam. Or pre-yoga, it's meant to bring you to that, where the meditation can really powerfully impact the mind and bring it to this state. And the symptom of this state is, this is just material, then this transcending it, is that it's illuminating. You can see things clearly, you perceive things clearer, and you feel a sense of happiness and contentment. So yes, very good. Anybody else like to share? They're all, yes. Name?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What?
I'm
Renee. Okay, yeah.
So,
yeah. I understand you. You. Very interesting, yes. Boy, I mean, this could be a whole class, but it's maybe we can exchange emails and even discuss this or something. But I would say this is, first know the science of how the actions, the environment, and your karma affect the consciousness. If you know that science, you can maximize each. You can have the right actions. Part of the environment is the how you associate with people, places, things, etc. So you have to make choices too. You know, like who you're with. You know, there are people that are not good associations. It doesn't mean you're not with them, but you're maybe not intimate with them. So that's one decision. And let's say someone's even in the city. I have a friend in the city. So that's all passion. What do? But they have a place. They keep things very clean. They have a place of worship. There's ways to impact the consciousness favorably. And sometimes we get caught in relation. Let's say we're stuck in a relationship, you know, that's debilitating. First, we have to see what's our commitment to that relationship. You know, if we get out of that relationship, that's debilitating because it's not healthy for our conscience. Let's say we can't. Let's say it's marriage and we feel like, right, we're committed to this, et cetera, we can't get out, it's not so healthy. Then there are other ways to look at it. Then one looks at what's called karma. They look at, wow, I'm going through a suffering situation. How is this meant to elevate my consciousness? So even if you can't change something that appears to be debilitating, you have the right knowledge and approach to it, you can extract the lesson of growth from it. In other words, everything that happens to us is actually a message of ourselves. And with the right guidance, the right understanding, no matter what the situation is, we could understand what it's saying to us and how to respond to get that message. So what I would say to you is, without knowing the particular of the situation, that there is enough knowledge and understanding and guidance, etc., that can help one understand that whatever one's situation is, they have full freedom to extract growth and development from it, either by changing things in their environment or responding to them in a different way. Does that make sense to you? Yeah. There's challenges we all have. You know, in America here, we have a lot of good karma and we have a lot of bad karma. And it's mixed up. You know, I mean, I can see, you know, Americans, because I live in India 7 months of the year, so I lived there 20 years straight. You know, Americans have a certain frankness, especially at a certain class of Americans, a certain frankness, a certain honesty, you know. But then family structures are destroyed, and we have baggage from that type of thing. But if we look, I would really say that our destiny is perfect for each person, because our destiny is aligned to what our conceptions and thoughts are and what experience we need to elevate ourselves in. It's a challenge. But that's why there's just, you know, that's why there's these yoga trainings and things to get the knowledge and get the energy. Thank you. Anybody else like to ask a question or? Yeah.
Mine was a question. When we look at evil in the world, do we think of evil as just that much farther removed from the true self, or a person who is evil? Do they have the potential to reach back to yourself in one lifetime?
Wow. Yeah.
Or is there just some case?
Interesting. Well, these are very interesting things, the conception of evil. Go ahead. To the extreme, yes. It's a mode. Well, let's say, if your question is a person evil, well, the person is not evil. The person is pure, but they're, in one sense, it's an identification. So what happens with a person like that is that type of consciousness makes them suffer so much that eventually the pain and suffering may give them the realization. I'll show you what karma is to show you what evil does to you. Let's say you exploit someone. That's evil. Evil is this, where your desire becomes so prominent, it overcomes any moral consideration. I mean, it's egotistical, but if you say, wow, I want this lady, I rape her. You know, I want this lady, I should be able to have sex with her. I want this land, I should be able to get it. It's a condition of egotism. And that's cultivated over many, many lifetimes that becomes so pronounced, and it's in us to a certain extent, where we put our desires above what's right and what we know it. So that conception is so disconnected from the self that but what will happen, this is how the law of karma, action and reaction works. That if you do this to someone, right, within you, you don't really see it, or you're not identifying it as wrong. You're thinking, my desire is what should be. I want this person. My desire is that, you know, I have some service, and I don't give a damn what this person thinks. It's right because, you know, you put your desire prominent. So there's something in you that's incongruent with the soul, right? Now, what karma does, there's a conception of Vishnu or God. He's observing this, and he also has compassion for the evil person. So what's the compassion? In the future, this person who's exploited becomes the victim of the same thing that was within him or her. Right? Now, what was in him is now outside of him, and he's the victim of it. So what happens when this happens? I don't like this. Well, what are you not liking? You're not liking that which is within you. I gave a seminar here Renee attended it, I think. Wasn't it Psychology of Karma one time where we discussed this? It's what's within you. So that's what happens to that person. And that's what's happening to us. What's coming to us within us to make us identify and condemn it, and therefore condemn what's in us. So yeah, that's evil. And I don't know how you get there, but I know how we can move towards there by being selfish, by transcending what's right for our own pleasures. It increases that desire. It increases the... And what you said, this ignorance, the mode of the mind of ignorance, one of the conceptions is a lack of morality. And I just tell an interesting story in that regard, is because whatever in here, you create an environment in your sound visions in the same way you create an environment. So there was a king in one dynasty many, many, many years ago, some Ming dynasty, and he had limited police force, but he wanted to put the police force where it could be most effective. So he wanted to find out where's the most crime. And you know how he found it out? He sent spies around because the communities were homogenous, you know, like one, not like today. You know, he sent spies around to listen to the music. So when he heard music in the mode of ignorance, he knew that people would be in the mode of ignorance and less moral. So it's a condition of the mind. So I have, there's one project in Newburgh, New York, which I'm connected with. It's going to be called Bent for a Change. And I'm connected with these brothers. They live together. It's much easier. One mortgage. You know, one kitchen. It's an Indian system. It takes a lot of sacrifice, but it has some. So they live together. Three are doctors. One is a pharmacist, and one is a business manager. You guys have one mortgage. They live together, but they've been able to buy this property and build this medical complex. And then I was just telling them, why don't we do something for poor people with yoga? This yoga is generally for people of affluence. And so we brought in this one lady, and it just, by God's grace, she, you know, happened to be the right person, and was building a yoga studio. And she found out that for every juvenile delinquent, the government spends $350,000. That's where our money's going. $350,000, why? Because the police that you have to keep on the streets, and when you the counseling, and then the detention centers, and then $350,000. They found out also that this city is the most violent in America, or something. And so what she's doing is she's working with different organizations. Even it's going to be researched by Harvard, Stanford, and these places, how yoga can elevate the mind. And it's because it helps bring the mind if you can teach it and inculcate it to a higher mode, there'll be less violence. So she wants to get this actually, she's working with some institute in California, which is coming over, that's already doing it, to try to get, you know, government at least to minimally invest in this, at least let the people into the schools where you can actually perhaps, teach some of these children and things like, at least when they're young, a better lifestyle, get it attracted to a higher mode. And then there'll be less evil. So thank you. Yes. Yeah. If you want, I can put you in touch with that lady. Okay, so afterwards we can, because it's a very dynamic program. And they want it duplicated. And she's working with an organization that does. And right now she wrote me that somehow or other there's a big conference on violence and they've invited her. It's a cutting-edge thing to combine the two. We can contact. I say that, well, we've done an hour and a half. Let's go a half hour more and then take a break. Okay? Okay, this is... I have a friend who wrote a book. I'll also recommend it, called Gita Wisdom, and he gives seminars. I'll write all those things down at the end. And I told him I'm giving the seminar, and he wrote me. He said, because he gives seminars at Jivan Mukti Institute, and he said, don't do all the talking. Because I've taught in another way, like in an Indian style, I think this is good. It's more engaging. Okay, let's go to the next section, okay? And I also have one friend I'd also recommend this to. He's wrote an incredible commentary on the Yoga Sutras, if any of you are interested. His name is Professor Edmund Bryant. And he regularly travels around the world giving these Bhagavad Gita seminars, and he gave me the verses that he covers. I have that. And of course, you can't always cover them all, but we'll get to that. Okay, now let's go to the first chapter. This is called The Yoga of Dejection. The Yoga of Dejection. Vishad Yoga. So this is the basic... Remember, the Bhagavad Gita is a chapter, a section of this great, much greater text that's probably bigger than the Iliad and the Odyssey combined, called the Mahabharata. And the basis of it is a fratricidal war, because there were three brothers, and one brother was born blind. And the brother who was born blind, when his father died, he couldn't become the king. Because the reason why a king has, and I'm not making a value judgment, has accoutrements of power, crowns and thrones, etc. Because in that system, they were supposed to be benevolent, but to manage, you want people to be reverent and to follow. And generally in this world, what people respect, what they submit to, is opulence. And don't think it's not American. When someone's a great athlete, when someone is very beautiful, we become fans. But I'm 60, so I remember this summer. I was watching the Ed Sullivan Show in my mother's room when the Beatles came to America. You can see opulence, how people worship it. So, and it still works in England today. So if someone was disabled, in that system, they couldn't be king. They were afraid of the psychology. So he couldn't become a king, and he developed a tremendous complex about it. So then, the next brother became the king, Pandu. But that brother died. Now, when that brother died, he was the king. So in that system of nepotism, his children, the Pandavas, the five brothers, they should have been the king. But this Dhritarashtra, the blind person who couldn't be the king, he made his own son the king. Now, these Pandavas, there's Dhritarashtra, there's Pandu. Dhritarashtra is blind, can't be the king, so his younger brother's the king. So his children, when he dies, become the king, but they were too young. So Dhritarashtra took them under his care, and he remained kind of like the king. But then, instead of making them the king, he made his own son the king. And it's a big intrigue that happens, but eventually, this Dhritarashtra's son, he's named Diodana, he tries to murder these his cousins who have the right to be the king. He tries to rape their wife. He sets fire to a house. So many things. He usurps their land. Eventually, they had to have half the kingdom because people complained, but then he cheated them out of that kingdom in a gambling match. They had to be in exile for 12 years. When they came back out of 12 years, they were supposed to get their kingdom back. He wouldn't give them their kingdom. And then they were so humble, these five Pandavas, that they just asked, can I have enough land, just five villages? Because that was their occupation in those times. The warrior had to have a village or some land. Otherwise, there's no occupation. And the emperor of the world, he's just asking for five villages in India. And this Duryodhana said, I will not even give you enough land to put on the head of a pin. And then there was no choice but to defend his family, the Pandavas, because it was obvious that this evil-minded cousin of theirs was an aggressor. So what happened is there was a world war. And in those particular days, warriors, they really had a spirit. I don't know if you've ever seen, but it's called a Kshatriya. A Kshatriya, Kshat means hurt, Triya means to protect. And they had a noble spirit. They were not afraid of death. I've met people like this in India from these lineages of kings. And you just can't believe the nobility. So somehow everyone was going to the war, and they took different sides, and sometimes people were obligated to take one side of another because someone had maintained them. So this whole world war is lined up. I don't know, here it is. This is the picture right here. You see, you can't see it too well. But then in the middle of this world war, armies, Arjuna, he's one of the great protagonists of the Bhagavad Gita, and he wanted to remain neutral in this war. But they wanted his armies. They wanted him to participate. So both the son of the blind king and Arjuna, who was the rightful heir to the king with his brothers, they went to Krishna. And Krishna said, okay, Arjuna, you can have either me, you can have my armies. And he chose Krishna. And the other person chose the armies. But Krishna vowed not to fight, so he's just going to drive the chariot, which is a driver is a kind of a low position. But he's an exalted person, but he's driving the chariot, which is a very interesting point in itself. Because it shows that what greatness is character, not position. And when people don't have character and want greatness, then often they seek position. And that's the modern political world, unfortunately. So this battle and the war is about to start, and all the conch shells are blowing. It's a very dramatic thing. I'm not going to go into the details, but the war is just about to start. You know, they have music because of the modes. You've got the right music, it can make you, and it's all lined up, the war, and they're about to fight. And then Krishna's driving the chariot, and Arjuna is one of the main generals. He says, well, let me see who's on the other side. So his chariot, his chariot is pulled in between all the armies, if you can see. And Krishna pulls the chariot, and he sees on the other side his grandfather who raised him, who was obligated to the other side just because of military rules. You know, that he was employed from them. He was working for them. And then he also saw his teacher, who taught him the military science, who is Dronacharya. So he sees his teacher, who is on this side because the general of Arjuna's side, Arjuna is the protagonist, the general of his side is his enemy, so he sees his relative, he sees his military guru, he sees his teacher. And then he has a tremendous dilemma. Should he fight or not? And I'm going to show how this is like an archetypal situation that we face. What we should be doing and our attachments are in conflict. What we should be doing, what is Dharma, what is the activity that will elevate us, and our attachments are in a great conflict. And then that a choice that we have to make and how to make it and the subtleties of it. Can any of you think of your own a situation like that? What? Going to work every day. Yeah. Yeah. Well, but that's an easy choice, though, right? You've made the right choice, but maybe there's something more subtle. Maybe you have to go to work every day and you decide to become a vegetarian, but you're working for McDonald's. I'm sorry, it's not you. But you know what I'm saying?
Or having to put your child in daycare when you have to go to work.
Okay, right.
There's a conflict there. What's your real responsibility?
Right. Whether you should give up your work and get something else or move out to the country and live simply off the land, or, yes.
Right.
But this is more an existential crisis that we all face. It's really about who am I and what my identity is. Can I tell you where I had my Bhagavad Gita moment? When I decided to become a monk, it was completely incomprehensible to my family. I mean, as far as they were concerned, you know, it would be I can't even describe what it was like, but it was like all of a sudden their college-educated son, who was a sportsman and the captain of his college team and ready for success in the world, decides to put on pajamas. I can't explain, which also is complicated by when you have a spiritual experience and you're young, then, and it's like this with any truth that really, really hit us, it's hard initially to balance it. There's a concept of truth, of metaphysics, that's beautiful. In Indian philosophy, it's called sambandhagyan. When you understand reality, it's called relationship. You have to understand the size of one truth to another truth. Like, for example, the truth that I had was detachment, that this life of, you know, whatever I was doing is only degrading the mind, and I can become relieved by some renunciation. I was feeling relieved, but then maybe the renunciation was too big and the detachment was too small. The attachment was too small. So that when you really get a good training and understand proper sacred texts from different... So maybe I'm putting my fault also. I couldn't communicate. I couldn't express it. You know, but the combination was that my family was so opposed that they hired people to kidnap me and to try to brainwash me by these, you know, these Chinese, whatever it is. They tried these psychological techniques to change my mind, which didn't work.
Did you think you had already been brainwashed?
They thought I was brainwashed.
Right.
So they were doing this, and they captured me, hired thugs. That's a good people. A very wonderful, not because they did that, but because, you know, they're decent people. I have a very incredible relationship with them. That was just part of the, you know, growing up, what I can explain, and they really respect me a lot. But that was my moment. Here are my parents, and they were faced on the other side, and here was my commitment of who I was internally and what was the highest truth, which was to follow and realize the soul. Now, there's no edict that when you want to follow and realize the soul that you have to give up your family. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita recommends the opposite. But sometimes choices are made between one dharma, one responsibility, and another responsibility. Yeah.
I have a good one. Yeah.
Please, you can share.
I guess I can explain. My family had me married in 4 weeks. And therefore, I was okay because I was married.
Yeah.
And then only after 30 weeks of marriage, I decided to get a divorce. And my family took me off of it and really embraced one of my husband because I wasn't meeting their family.
Yeah.
But happier.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Right. Yeah. No, there's choices like that. I mean,
that's huge.
I just a person of mine, a student of mine who studied Bhagavad Gita very, 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 very sincerely. And you know, he got married to someone, and this can't go on the phone. I think the class must be finished. Is anybody still there? Anybody still there? Anybody want to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, I'm still here.
Okay, I won't use this example. What can I do?
It's too late.
What? Gail, no. You don't understand. If it's a group that doesn't know the community.
Yeah.
The system's dear people. I've been doing this for 3.5 years. And I give on different types of texts, but there's a steady group of people that listen. And I thought the class was only, the conference call was only an hour and a half maximum. Okay. So sometimes it's like that, a situation where someone has a bad marriage, they have children, and perhaps it would be easier to leave. Maybe even the other partner wants to leave. You know what I'm saying? It may be difficult to you. It may be better for the children. It may be, you know, so sticking to Dharma in the face of attachments. And the reaction. And what's the Arjuna's reaction, Krishna's going to inspire him to fight. What I should do right now, and then we're going to take a break, is I'm going to read from the Bhagavad Gita itself now. And you'll get an idea of the conflict. And then we're going to discuss how the anxiety, how we approach dejection and the world as a impetus to understand something deeper. Okay, and then we can take a break. All right, and then continue. So far, hey, 2 hours. We're still alive. That's great. So I'll start. So the armies are lining up. War is about to begin. The conch shells are blowing. And then Arjuna says, he's the one who's facing the other people. Oh, infallible one, he's talking to Krishna. Please draw my chariot between the two armies, so that I may see who is present here, who is desirous of fighting, and with whom I must contend in this great battle attempt. Let me see who have come here to fight, wishing to please the evil-minded Dhritarashtra. Who's on the other side that wants to satisfy this person who's tried to rape my wife, tried to usurp my thing? Who's on the other side? Sanjaya said, this is being narrated, Bhagavad Gita, to Dhritarashtra, who's not on the battlefield. He's blind. He's not on the battlefield. But it's being narrated by his assistant called Sanjaya, who's a mystic. Even though he's on the battlefield, he's seeing the whole thing. So he's now telling Dhritarashtra what's happening. He said, Sanjaya said, oh, this the bar, being thus addressed by Arjuna, Krishna drew up the fine chariot in the midst of the armies of both parties. So Krishna, and this is the part of the guide, this is the part of God, to make us confront our attachments. Because the attachments are what bind the soul to the body. So you have to confront your attachments, especially the ones which you are eligible now to give up. Some of your attachments you have to work through, but some you have to give up. They're not healthy. So the divine, incarnate or within the heart, makes arrangements for us in situations where we have to confront our attachments. That our attachments are opposed to our development. So this is what happens. He's drawing it. In the presence of Bhishma, Drona, and the other chieftains of the world, so in the presence of these great warriors who oppose, Rishikesh, that's Krishna, the Lord, said, just behold, Partha, that's Arjuna, the son of Pritha, all the Kurus are assembled here. Bhishma, he puts it right in the face. Look, you want to see? Oh, my God, there's my grandfather, there's... Then Arjuna could see, and this is what he sees, within the midst of the armies of both parties, his fathers, grandfathers, teachers, maternal uncles, brothers, sons, grandsons, friends, and also his father-in-law and well-wishers, all present. When the son of Kunti, Arjuna, saw all these different grades of friends and relatives, he became overwhelmed with compassion and began to speak. So what your meditation will be in the break, which is coming up in 10 minutes, is do you agree with Arjuna or not and his decision not to fight? Okay, and now it's saying that he was compassionate. Compassion is good. So he has good qualities, Arjuna. He's qualified. But compassion is not also good, just like if you're in a codependent relationship. You're kind, you're nice, you do everything, you get exploited. So it's good that you're kind and compassionate, but your duty is to break that relationship and transcend it and be even. You understand? So the sentimentality, the compassion is a good quality. I was just like speaking to one friend about this morning, and he gave the example of a friend of his was running a monk. He's running a monastery, and some guy walked off the street and just said, "Hey man, I'm doing this like this, and if you just lend me $10, I he gave him the $10. I'll be back tomorrow to pay." Never saw him again. So the compassion is a good quality, but it may not always be the quality that we have to guide ourselves with. But anyway, but it was good. Arjuna said, "My dear Krishna, seeing my friends and relatives present before in such a fighting spirit, I feel the limbs of my body quivering. and my mouth is drying up. So this, he's having depression. He's having dejection. What the hell? What do I do? Look at this situation. In Sanskrit, he's going to say, I translate into my local vernacular, it's going to come up. He basically says, damned if I do, damned if I don't. Whichever way I turn, the opposite's going to happen. Whichever way I turn to satisfy my desires, just like I said, a codependent relationship. If I leave to satisfy my desires, then I'll be distressed. If I stay in it, I'll be distressed. Where do I turn? The world is meant to put us in these situations to bring us to a higher state of consciousness. Because once we're on that platform of prakriti and identifying with the body and matter, we're always going to be full of duality. Because we're investing in something that's temporary and not us. So the pleasure actually won't hit our soul ultimately. The example is given sometime like a bird cage. A guy buys a bird, and gets a beautiful bird cage. And then he starts polishing the bird cage. He becomes enamored with the bird cage and gets to feed the bird. So it's kind of like that. The body is, you get enamored with it. It's a vehicle for something else, but you forget its purpose. And then if you just identify with it and don't use it to elevate your consciousness, then everything that you become attached to causes you pain. And the more you enjoy something, the more equally you're going to suffer. So this is the philosophy that's the basis of this. My whole body is trembling and my hair is standing on end. My bow, Gandiva, is slipping from my hands. I'm unable to stand here any longer. I am forgetting myself, and my mind is reeling. This is one of the most powerful warriors of all time. But this is heaven. I have a friend who gives a seminar to try to show people what it's like. He tells everyone to bring the picture of the person he loves the most. And then he says, now paste them on the board. Okay, and then he gives everyone a dart, and he says, now throw it at that picture, and people start shaking, and the dart is falling from their hands, and it's not even real. So trying to give you an idea of the existential crisis, which we all face, and we'll certainly face it then. We'll face the illusion of non-existence, which is the most frightening thing, unless you can rise above it. I do not see how any good can come from killing my own kinsmen in the battle, nor can I, my dear Krishna, desire any subsequent victory, kingdom, or happiness, because the people we want to enjoy with, he's going to have to kill. And also, our identity is in terms of relationships. Right? I am a son, I am a father. So if someone dear to you, gone, part of you is gone. A mother loses a child, then her whole existence is a son loses the mother, then that part of him is a son. So his whole identity is being challenged. And which really leads to the point, do we have an eternal identity that's not subject to just complete change? And again, it's not going to recommend renunciation. It's going to recommend a change of consciousness and to take your desires and attachments and try to find Dharma, how to deal with them in a progressive way so that they can be satisfied to make the mind peaceful for spiritual life so that you can make a plan to eventually give them up before you die and it's all going to be taken. O Govinda, that's the name of Krishna, of what avail to us are kingdoms, happiness, or life itself, when all those for whom we may desire them are now arrayed on this battlefield? O Madhusudana, when teachers, fathers, sons, grandfathers, maternal uncles, father-in-laws, grandsons, brother-in-law, and all relatives are ready to give up their lives and properties and are standing before them, then why should I wish to kill them, though I may survive? O maintainer of all creatures, I am not prepared to fight with them, even in exchange for the three worlds, let alone this life. So he's a pious person. There's something more important to him than externals. Where most people, oh, my son's on the, I'll disown that. And look what he's done. I'll disown it. I've seen that in my own family with an uncle and his son. It's like, to say, you know, opposition. So there's some piety here. So he has some good qualities, no doubt. But is he making the right decision? That's what we have to see. Sin will overcome us if we slay such aggressors. Sin means, basically, reaction. You do something wrong, it's going to come back to you to help you understand it's wrong. It's a law of karma. It can be proved scientifically that a law of karma exists. I do things with astrology, the Vedic astrology, and it's very interesting. I can walk into a class if you gave me your information. Is Elisa here? Okay. You wrote me about that. You can give me, I'll get that done for you. Okay. So, where I can walk in and basically say, you know, who's such and such, and I can tell about them without meeting them. I can tell something that happened in their life. And so it's there because there's a karma. It's mapped. It's just a little bit. But it's a thing. This is wrong. It's wrong, and I'll get a reaction. Therefore, it's not proper for us to kill the sons of Dhritarashtra and our friends. What should we gain, O Krishna, husband of the goddess of fortune, and how can we be happy in killing our own kinsmen? Janardana, although these men overtaken by greed see no fault in killing one's family or quarreling your friends, why should we, with knowledge of the sin, engage in these acts? Why should I be with that? And then it describes what happens in a family when you kill elders. Then the children have no guidance. And this is everyone's going to be killed. And then there's just a few more verses. Oh, Krishna, maintainer of the people, I've heard by disciplic succession that those who destroy the family traditions dwell in hell. And how strange it is that we're preparing to commit great sinful acts driven by the desire for royal happiness. I would consider it better for the sons of Dhritarashtra to kill me unarmed and resisting